When a storm knocks out power for a few hours, it's an inconvenience, much longer, and it becomes a crisis. But generations of Iowans lived their whole lives without electricity. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we'll look back at the electrification of rural Iowa, which came decades after most of Iowa's towns and cities were connected to the grid. I'll talk with two Iowans who remember when their farms got electricity, and with Terry Queck-Matzey, who's written about this period for the Iowan magazine. We'll also talk about the role of rural electric co-ops then and technological innovations from RECs today. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Starting in the 1880s, electrical lines started running to Iowa towns. Rural electrification was a much lower priority. In fact, by 1930, 90% of farms in Iowa were still without electricity. Over the next two decades, rural electric cooperatives brought power to rural Iowa and transformed life on the farm. This hour, I'll talk with Terry Queck-Matzey, who wrote about the electrification of rural Iowa for the Iowan magazine. We'll also talk about the role of rural electric co-ops today. But first, Keith Wirt remembers when electricity came to his family's farm in Panora, Iowa. He was only 10 years old when it happened. Hi, Keith.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here today. And now, Keith, before electricity came to your farm, I know that you had a run-in with a kerosene lamp that could have been very, very serious. Tell me what happened.
Well, I was upstairs, and I was the youngest of eight kids, and we had kerosene lights and kind of a cheesecake-like curtains there, and my hand went back after I lit the lamp, not knowing that it was still lit, and it caught the curtains on fire. And my sister that was in a room right next to that way, she came in and jerked it down and stomped it out.
Ugh.
So otherwise, I still live in the house that I was born in 83 years ago. So
wow,
still standing.
Yeah, so that's a very clear memory of one of the inconveniences of not having electricity. Do you remember the day that electricity came to the farm?
Maybe not today, but I do remember that how things changed from never had even an ice box, I guess, because we kept our milk in jars in a bucket with a rope, let it down in the well. But it was pretty nice when we finally got a refrigerator.
I guess a lot of us think about the lights first and foremost, but a refrigerator is a huge thing that can really change your life. Also, of course, indoor plumbing came shortly after electricity, right?
Yeah, it did. I think it might have been a few years before we got that, but it was a change from going out, especially in the wintertime, sitting on that cold seat privy that might have had a little snow on it.
Oh. Plus, I'll bet it was pretty dark out there, too.
Well, it could have been. You usually tried to get a brother and sister to go along with you so you wasn't so scared. But
oh. Now, a few other farmers in your area got electricity starting in 1939, and your family got electricity a couple years later. But how was it decided what farms would get the electrical lines?
Well, most anybody could if you had money, and I guess my parents didn't think they could afford it right away, but I remember the price. It was $4.08 for 45 kilowatts. Back when we first got it, we hardly used 45. Now I have ground source heat and everything in the house is electric, and I use 2,000 or 3,000 a month. So
wow.
It's a change.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Okay, so thank you and good luck.
Keith Wirt is a cattle farmer in Panora. He lives in his childhood home, which is connected to the electric grid in 1941. With me now is Terry Quek-Matzie. She is a journalist based in Fontenelle, and she's also the author of the article, How the Prairie Was Lit, Iowa's Rural Electric Cooperatives Turned the Lights On in Rural Iowa and Still Bring Technology Innovation, which recently appeared in the Iowan Magazine. She's also the author of 75 Years of Progress, The Farmers Electric Cooperative. Hello, Terry.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And Terry, cities and towns started getting electricity in the United States in the late 1880s, the early 1890s, and electrification moved pretty fast across the country for cities and towns. But it took a lot longer for rural areas. Why is that?
Well, it was very similar to the scenario we have today with the rural broadband issues, in that the power companies just couldn't see a profit margin in providing that infrastructure.
And it was so many decades later that the electrification started coming to rural areas. I think that's the biggest surprise. Even if the profit margin is low, still, it was years and years before farms started getting lit up in Iowa.
Oh, absolutely. And the movement kind of started. There were studies done in the 20s on how it would increase efficiency on the farm and so forth. But it really, the Rural Electrification Administration was sort of a product of the New Deal. And actually, it was Henry Wallace who was involved on the very front end of that. He was getting pressure from farmers, as he was Secretary of Ag, to increase their quality of life. And so that all tied in. I said, then the New Deal came, and then they created the REA, which was essentially a loan program.
That was the Rural Electrification Act of the 1930s.
Right, right.
And once this started happening, of course, there had to be organizations in these rural areas that would bring the electricity, rural electric cooperatives. How did that interaction go with government funding and of course, local interest?
Well, in Greenfield, the history book that I did was on the Farmers Cooperative in, or Farmers Electric Cooperative based in Greenfield. And in that area, it was actually a county agent who kind of took the bull by the horns, so to speak, and started rallying some key community people. And then, you know, word spread. There were public meetings. There were conversations at the sale barn, you know, around dinner tables, and just that gradual getting everybody on board.
And there were farmers, of course, who were really eager to have electricity at their homes. I've read that some of them even went out and started digging the holes for the power line posts to go into.
They cleared trees. They dug holes. They set poles. There's one area farmer from Fontenelle who he and his father-in-law actually took the round plates off of a disc and designed a post hole digger so they could dig the holes that much faster.
And neighbors had to work together to bring electricity to their farms. Did this create some conflict?
Occasionally. The system was set up so that you had to have an entire neighborhood on board. And so if you had someone who was holding out and maybe didn't think they could afford it or wasn't interested, there was pressure on those people to sign up.
Did this create some conflicts with Amish neighbors who, of course, didn't want the electricity?
I have heard that, and that wasn't part of the research that I did, but I have heard that from other sources, that yes, because they obviously needed those people to sign up, and they weren't interested because of their beliefs and their lifestyle, and there was a lot of negative feelings toward them there for several years because of that.
So this was a gradual process in the 1930s. What happened when World War II came along?
Everything sort of went on hold. For the Farmers Electric, they were formed in 38. And their first live line was, I believe, March of 1940. So by this point, they were getting people, you know, starting to get people online. Well, then when the war came, they had neither labor nor materials. Everything was directed to the war effort. So things sort of went on hold, and there was minimal progress here and there, but not much. It was really after the war then that things really took over.
When electricity came to those farms, what you've talked to a number of people who went through that transition and remember that transition. What are the stories that you hear? What's the first thing that people remember getting that really made a difference?
Well, probably 90% of the people, it was a refrigerator. There were other household appliances and some farming tools, but refrigerator is number one on the list.
In fact, we have a caller on the line right now, Barb from West Des Moines, who fondly remembers her first refrigerator. Hello, Barb.
Hello, Charity. We didn't. I remember when the REA came through and Dad and my uncle ran the wire from the road into the house. You know, we had the one bare bulb hanging in the kitchen area for a while, but it was electricity. But to the point of the refrigerator, we did not have a refrigerator until after my brother returned from World War II. And, you know, we just put the milk and the butter and all that stuff in the cellar. And he always was around, you know, he always knew somebody that knew somebody. And he found a refrigerator, a Kelvinator, and the problem was that it had been through a fire and the top of it was scorched, but the, you know, the rest of it was fine. So he obtained that refrigerator and brought it. He and my other brother brought it to the house, and while Mom was out choring, they brought it in and set it in the only place there was, and had to run the outlet up and to the light, the hanging light fixture, to plug it in. But she did not mind that the top of it was scorched. She just put a scarf on it and used it happily.
Well, I'm sure that changed a lot for her and a lot for you.
And one of the jokes that we always played with her was the fact that she put the salt and pepper in there one time without thinking. You know, we were looking and looking for it, and my brother said, well, you really don't have to put the salt and pepper in the refrigerator, Mom.
Once she had the power, she wanted to refrigerate everything. That's great, Barb. Where did you grow up, Barb?
Outside of Madrid.
All right. Well, Barb, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story today.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Talk of Iowa, and you can call and share your story if this is something that you remember as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me now is Terry Quek-Matzie. She is a journalist based in Fontenelle, and she wrote the article, How the Prairie Was Lit, for the Iowan Magazine. We're talking about rural electrification today. We're also going to spend more time talking about rural electric co-ops, which of course still provide power for rural areas of Iowa, and they are a hotbed of technological innovation. We'll talk about that as the hour goes on as well. And again, you're welcome to join us. 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about rural electrification in Iowa. We'll also talk about the role of rural electric cooperatives in the state during electrification and today in just a moment. But next, we're going to hear from somebody who has a long memory of many things that have happened in our state. Evelyn Berkby is one of Iowa's most beloved and well-known homemakers. She's also a columnist for the Shenandoah Valley News. She's been writing her column Up a Country Lane for more than 60 years. And her most recent book is called Always Put in a Recipe. Evelyn, when you were growing up, you lived in town, so you had access to electricity, but you did spend time in the country where the electric lines hadn't been run yet. Where did you go that didn't have electricity?
Well, the main place where I went was to my grandmother's and my aunt's, and they lived in Murdoch, Illinois, near Decatur, Illinois, and every summer we would go and visit them for a while. And both my grandmother and my aunt, I remember doing without electricity, and I was fascinated. I thought this was such fun. to have these little lamps at night because they would have the kerosene lamps. They were a lot of work because they had to be filled at least once a week with kerosene to keep them going. And then you had to wash them often. Those glass globes, the wicks had to be trimmed.
So that must have seemed kind of magical to you. But I can imagine that for the women who had to do the cooking and the washing, doing all of that without electricity probably didn't feel very magical at all.
Well, when I first moved to a farm, when Robert and I were married, this was in 1948, we moved to a little farm south of Farragut here in southwest Iowa, and at first we did not have electricity.
Really? In 1948?
I don't tell you how long we lived that way because it wasn't really very long, but I can say to you or to somebody else, oh yes, I moved to the farm and didn't have electricity till it came through. Within a month we had electricity.
Oh, nice.
But you see, I can say.
Right, that you lived without it. But so in that brief period of time, did you have to cook with a wood stove?
We had a big wood range in the kitchen. We also got a gas stove. Thinking back with my grandmother and my aunt, they didn't have an ice box even. They had a big well, a deep well, near their back doors. And down in that well was a big bucket. And it was on a rope. And they would crank it, you know, down into the well or bring it back up. What they did was to put their milk and their cream and their butter in that bucket and put it down in that well.
Wow.
Because then if you didn't have electricity, you didn't have a refrigerator. And if you drive through the countryside, you can still see those humpy things in the backyard,
mm-hmm.
a hill of some kind that they could dig into. And that's where my grandmother kept her eggs. And then the produce, like apples, all of those things that you glean in the fall and put down into the caves. And this is what our pioneer families did.
Evelyn, thank you so much.
I love visiting with you, and thank you for having me.
Evelyn Berkby is a columnist for the Shenandoah Valley News. She's been writing her column, Up a Country Lane, for more than 60 years. And we are talking about rural electrification today, sharing some memories. If you have memories to share, you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. And with me is journalist Terry Queck-Matzey. She wrote an article called How the Prairie Was Lit for the Iowan Magazine. And Terry, talking to Evelyn and thinking about how much things changed for the women on the farm once the electricity came. And we'll talk about how it changed farming in a moment. But really, how electricity transformed housework maybe was the biggest revolution.
Oh, it absolutely transformed everything and the entire family. I don't know how many men I've talked to who talk about having to clean those chimneys on those lamps every night as they were little boys and having to do that. And the fire risk, you know, keeping kerosene next to the cook stove. You know, it's amazing things didn't just all burn up and go away. But yeah, think of things like the difference between an electric iron and the old flat irons. You know, it just goes on and on. There's any number of new developments.
Well, and of course, washing machines eventually and electric ranges and electric different kinds of things that you could use in the kitchen. I mean, just whipping up egg whites was radically transformed as well.
And as one man said to me, and he sat there, and Elvin Tanat, who I quote in the article, and he's sitting there holding his iPhone 4. And he says, you know, it's like having the iPhone 4 and the iPhone 5 comes out. He said, it really did happen that fast, that you just constantly had this barrage of new products and new things. He said, you had a little bit of money, you bought the latest new thing.
So outside of the house, on the farm, what are some of the big changes that came with electrification?
Well, those electric water pumps were also pumping water to stock tanks that before that had had to be filled by hand. Yard lights, lights in the barn. It wasn't long before you started to see egg production facilities coming online and things like electric milking machines.
And let's just talk about egg production, because if hens don't get about 12 hours of light a day, they're not going to lay their eggs. So that made eggs available year-round.
Right, right. And to be able to produce them in a larger scale on, I hesitate to say an industrial scale, but at that time it was. Electric egg counting machines. Roll away pens, crates. You had grain dryers that came later. Any number of things like that that enabled farmers to meet at that time, right after World War II, they were hit with an incredible demand. You know, urban populations were growing, and those urban populations who couldn't produce their own food wanted affordable and safe food. You had that post-war boom, the baby boom and the economic boom. So right at the time that the farmers were expected to meet this incredible demand, the guys were returning home from the war and taking over the family farms and wanting to modernize, and electricity just fed all that.
Well, and did it change things socially as well? Because this separation between the cities and towns that had electricity and the farms that didn't have electricity for really a couple of decades, at least, that created something of a social divide. Did that social division between rural and urban or small town life, did that close a little bit?
Oh, I think it probably did. It definitely was an equalizer there. By that time you had a lot of country kids who were going to town to school. That increased, as the labor needs grew less, you had more people working in town. You had more farm wives that were maybe taking a job. You know, all that happened somewhat gradually through the 50s and 60s. And in some ways, the availability of the technology and the free time to do that was ahead of the social norms that allowed some of that.
I'm talking with Terry Queck Matzey. She's a journalist based in Fontenelle, and she recently published the article How the Prairie Was Lit in the Iowan Magazine. And now, of course, these rural electric cooperatives that brought electricity to the rural areas of Iowa are still providing electricity to rural areas of Iowa and doing some very interesting and innovative things as well. I want to bring a couple of people who are very closely associated with these RECs into the conversation. Joining me now is Warren McKenna. He is general manager of Farmers Electric Cooperative based in Kelowna. And we were talking about Farmers Electric Cooperative in Adair County based in Greenfield. And this is the other Farmers Electric Cooperative. Hello, Warren.
Thanks, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
And we also have Jim Sayers is with us as well. He's Energy Services Director of Corn Belt Power Cooperative based in Humboldt, Iowa. Hello, Jim.
Hey, good morning.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, and Warren, for people who have never bought their power from a rural electric co-op and maybe didn't even know there were RECs in the state, tell me a little bit about the area that you cover. How large an area do you cover, and how many customers do you have?
We're one of the smallest co-ops in Iowa, and we cover north of Kelowna, primarily an Amish area, actually, over to Hills, Iowa, and north of Wellman, Iowa. We're about, 650 customers.
All right. And Jim, how large an area do you cover?
Well, I work for Corn Belt Power Cooperative. We're a generation and transmission REC, which makes us the power supplier to local co-ops like the Farmers Group. So we're headquartered in Humboldt, Iowa. We have about 30 counties within our area, but we serve 9 member distribution co-ops.
All right. So you're one step up the ladder.
Well, we're the power supply, but we are owned by our distribution co-ops, yeah.
And Warren, where does Farmers Electric Co-op buy their power?
We buy our power through a power buying group. It's a a different arrangement than the co-ops. We buy with the Amana colonies and a few cities spread in southeast Iowa primarily.
All right. Well, and Jim, I know that with a lot of RECs and with your organization, there is a real focus on energy efficiency and helping your customers become more energy efficient. That seems a little counterintuitive since you sell electricity, but why is that such an important focus for you?
Well, you're right. Energy efficiency is a big, in fact, a very big activity we have today in our area. But I think it goes back many, many years ago, too. And it was interesting to hear a little bit about the history of when the REA came and the RECs started. Some of the talk was about appliances, importance of refrigerators. I think that was mentioned by Terry this morning. But, you know, as the houses have grown, the number of appliances and choices have grown and grown, we've seen that electricity use has also grown. And so I think our focus today on energy efficiency is maybe not so much how to use less, but how to use what you use wisely, don't waste it, do more work with the minimum amount of energy and electricity.
Well, on Monday on this program, we were talking about deconstruction, and a figure got thrown around that more than 50% of homes in Iowa are considered to be dilapidated, and that means that they are well below the energy efficiency codes of today. And that is, of course, very true in a lot of rural areas. So, Warren, is energy efficiency something that a lot of your clients struggle with living in these rural areas, a lot of them in big old farmhouses?
Yeah, we get calls weekly on, of course, power bills, and lately, because of the hard winter, we've received a lot of calls. So, yes, it's a big deal when your bill jumps up 20-30%.
Right, right. Well, and this has been a brutal winter for anybody heating, whether they were heating with electricity or of course, we've talked a lot about LP this winter and how incredibly expensive that has been. But you probably have customers paying hundreds of dollars, $500, $600 a month to heat their homes.
Correct. The average bill is around $130. And if you heat with electric, we do have a heat rate. It's about a break even on the heat rate, but it does beat LP this year considerably. So we're adding value, let's put it that way, and we're competitive, but it still takes a lot of heat this winter.
Right. Jim, I know that your organization works with something called Iowa Touchstone Energy Homes. Can you tell me about this project?
Well, sure. I think first I might mention just Touchstone Energy in general. It's a national coalition of electric co-ops. It's about, well, it's 15 years old now this year, actually. Corn Belt Power and most of the RECs in Iowa are members of Touchstone Energy. But yeah, the focus, one of the programs I should back up and say of Touchstone Energy is to focus on energy efficient homes. And so one of the programs offered is called the Touchstone Energy Home. Pretty much it's a list of prescriptive standards, recommendations for building an energy efficient home. And in our case, Corn Belt Power and our co-ops have adopted this. We've kind of modified the standards here for Iowa. We've utilized expertise from our friend Bill McAnally, who I know you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's helped us a lot to look at standards for building primarily or remodeling to make your home as efficient as possible. And so we promote the Touchstone Energy Home through training, through resources we print, that kind of thing.
Now, what kind of incentives are there for, and Warren, you can weigh on this as well, because I know that you share advice with people about making their homes more energy efficient and advice about what products not to use that are huge energy users as well. But what kinds of incentives can you offer to your customers to become more energy efficient? And Warren, I'll let you go first.
We offer a refrigerator is a major, as we talked about, it's still a major user in the home. So to upgrade your refrigerator, we offer rebates on those. We run a blitz once in a while where we'll double the rebate for refrigerator freezers, and they're quite successful. Also, we have the solar option as well now, which you can help reduce your overall bill. And lighting is a big deal right now with the onset of LEDs and the barnyard lights that were mentioned. So we're hitting those pretty hard in the next few years to get those changed to LEDs.
Well, and I want to talk more about your solar program after we come back from a break here in just a moment. But, Jim, before we get to the break, I'll let you weigh in on that. What kinds of incentives can electricity providers provide to their customers?
Well, Charity, I'm looking at a pie chart right now that says, you know, looking at the average use in a home, space heating or heating and cooling account for about 45% of the average home's energy costs. Water heating accounts for about 18 to 20%. So add those two together, you have a big chunk of all your energy cost is on heating and cooling or on water heating. And so some of our programs incentives, gosh, they go back almost as long as I've been at Corn Belt Power, to the 1980s, promoting high-efficiency water heaters and high-efficiency heat pumps. And heat pumps meaning geothermal or air source heat pumps. But those are in particular have been a focus of ours for many, many years just because they use so much energy in a typical home. But like Warren mentioned, a number of programs today include lighting, new appliances, appliance recycling. That list kind of goes on and on because of you know, our realization of more needs and ways to help members save energy.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about rural electric co-ops. We've been talking about the electrification of rural Iowa. And if you have stories you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. If you remember when electricity came to your part of the state, or maybe there were stories told in your family, give us a call, 866-780-9100. I'm talking with Warren McKenna of Farmers Electric Co-op in Kelowna, Jim Sayers of Corn Belt Power Cooperative in Humboldt, Iowa, and journalist Terry Quek Matzie. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about rural electrification. We looked back at the history in the 1930s and 40s when power came to rural areas of Iowa and how that transformed life on the farm. With Terry Quek Matzie, she's a journalist based in Fontanelle, and she's also the author of the article, How the Prairie Was Lit, Iowa's Rural Electric Cooperatives Turned the Lights On in Rural Iowa and Still Bring Technological Innovation, that recently appeared in the Iowan magazine. Also, we have with us Warren McKenna, who is general manager of Farmers Electric Co-op based in Kelowna, and Jim Sayers, energy services director of Corn Belt Power Cooperative based in Humboldt, Iowa. And before we get back into talking about RECs today, we have another listener with a memory to share, and you can share yours at 866-780-9100. And Richard is here on the line with us. Hi, Richard.
How you doing?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Oh, I was just telling whoever answered the phone there about my neighbor in New Mexico. When the REC first came out, they were signing everybody up, I think it was for $25 a month.
All
right. And, well, they finally figured out where he lived at. He lived about 2.5 miles off the main road. So they called him up and said, well, we can't hook you up for that price. You'll have to pay more. And he said, well, I've got your canceled check. You're going to hook me up. And they did. So he got his power pretty cheap that time.
Well, and that does underscore the incredible challenge it was to run electricity to all of the rural areas in the United States, not just in Iowa, Richard.
Oh, yeah. Because he lived, well, that was high desert then, really.
All right.
He finally got his power.
And you're in Holstein, Iowa. Are there any stories told in that area about when electricity came?
Well, I can remember when I was a kid, we first got electricity.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we had we had DC power at the time when it first came out, and they didn't like it, so they had to shift. They had to put a motor or something in to change it because. The cows got into it. They didn't like it at all.
So, Richard, do you remember how that changed life when you had reliable power?
Well, yeah, it was a few years. Oh, yeah, I can remember that because then, well, we never had an inside bathroom. We always had an outhouse. And once we got power, we got everything else to go along with it. And we finally got inside plumbing, which was nice. And then later on in the 50s, we got a TV set, which was really nice.
Right. Very exciting.
Yeah.
Well, Richard,
I remember watching Howdy Doody and a few others, you know, when I was a kid.
That's great. Richard, thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Okay.
Well, And Terry, I've got to say, you said most people said talked about the refrigerator and how great it was to get a refrigerator. But we've certainly heard a lot about having an indoor bathroom.
Oh, absolutely. And again, going back to the article, Shirley Tanat had commented that she grew up in town. And so when she married Elvin, right about the time electricity was coming in, said she had real reservations about moving to the farm where she would have to use the privy. She really didn't care for that at all. So having that indoor bathroom was a major luxury.
Well, and I know that you have done a great deal of research about the rural electric co-op in your area, the other farmers electric co-op in the state. And can you characterize for us how RECs in the state are interacting with their customers today and innovating? Because they really do seem to be a kind of a hotbed of innovation as far as power goes.
They absolutely are, and they're also very valuable community members and community partners. The REC in Greenfield is involved in a windmill project where a group of private investors has built, I want to say, 5 or 6 windmills now. I'm not sure about that number to be exact, but and the REC buys the power directly from them. And that's a very unique setup, and that actually accounts for, I want to say, about 8% of REC's power. And again, back to being the community partners, they're big on community service. They're involved in community projects. And in, I believe it was the mid-'80s, several RECs joined together to form the Iowa Area Development Group, which is designed to promote economic development, particularly in rural areas, and bring industry to rural areas that will use power. And they're just very, very much a part of things and very vital and very innovative.
Well, and on the subject of innovation, Warren McKenna with Farmers Electric Co-op in Kelowna, Farmers Electric is ranked 3rd nationally by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory for the percentage of customers participating in green power programs. And you've really focused a lot on solar energy at Farmers Electric Co-op. Warren, tell me a little bit about when your solar program started.
We started our venture into solar in about 2008, 2009 with the introduction of a solar garden, which is near our substation, where we let people purchase solar modules, and then they get a credit on their power bill for that module for the production.
Well, and that's such an interesting idea, because I know a lot of people who live in rural areas would love to have a windmill or have a solar array, but the price is very high. It's extremely difficult to get into that. So you're giving people an opportunity to buy just really part of a solar array, just a module that will go on an array that has how many modules?
About 10 modules to an array in the garden, 6 to 10.
And how many arrays do you have?
That's a good question. Probably a dozen out back there, right around a dozen or so. There's about 70 owners, 70 different customers that actually own modules, and some own multiple modules. We have a church that owns 6. Some businesses own several.
And why did you choose to focus on solar?
Southeast Iowa, we don't have the wind resources that they have in central and western Iowa. So solar does as well as wind, and we don't have to climb the tower.
I'm sure that's a big incentive. So I mentioned this ranking 3rd nationally as far as the percentage of customers participating in green power programs. How many of your customers do participate?
Well, I'm not exactly sure, but about 20% are either own solar or participate in the solar garden, or have a credit on their bill, or have a charge on their bill that they will support solar.
Okay.
Or other renewable energy. We also have buy some biodiesel for our generators.
And with the solar arrays, they get a credit on their bill for the amount of power produced by these solar panels. But it's going to take a long time for that to pay off the actual purchase of the module, right?
Not exactly. Right, 7 years.
7 years. Okay.
Yep.
All
and
right.
Then you own it, and you still get the credit.
All right. So it's an investment in the future.
Correct.
And it strikes me that the people who are willing to make that investment are probably people who are very invested in this part of the state. People are going to be here a long time. This is not a transient population.
Yeah, you can't take the solar module with you once we sell it to you. It does stay with the account. You can transfer ownership. You get an actual ownership certificate with the serial number of the module, so you do own the module.
When somebody leaves, what happens?
We haven't had that happen yet, but I have had a transfer of one ownership of one module in the
All
farm.
Right. All right. Well, I think the fact that you haven't had that happen yet tells us a lot about your population.
Yeah, pretty stable.
Well, and Jim, I mean, I think it is interesting that the people who are customers of these rural electric co-ops are deeply invested in the land and in the area where they live. Is that something that you observe?
Well, I think that's a true statement about electric co-ops anywhere in the country right now, probably. And I guess a little comment about the power supply. One thing is a power supplier, as Corn Belt Power is, we want to look at a balanced power supply source. I mean, renewable is one piece and a very important piece, but certainly the challenge of renewable energy in general is that it's available when the sun is shining, when the wind is blowing. However, as a power supplier, we have to have the capacity there for providing for members' needs when the sun is not shining and the wind is not blowing. So as co-ops look at it on a general basis, looking at balanced power, that's very important.
Right. Warren, have you felt that your investment in solar has paid off?
Yeah, it helps us, solar does at least, cut our peak. And we also take wind off the grid, the big wind, so we buy some of that. And it is a mix, as Jim mentioned. So it's going to take a mix of energy to make everything work here in Iowa.
Terry, from your perspective, are RECs more likely to invest in some of the newer kinds of energy than bigger power companies?
I think so. They just seem to have an innovative approach. And you know, their primary mission is to serve their members. So if solar or wind or whatever new developments there might be out there serve the membership, then they're going to go for it. Now, in Adair County, with the windmill situation with Farmers Electric, I want to add there that, you know, we also see the tax benefits of locally produced power.
Warren, we've talked about that you have a fairly small customer base. You have 6 employees at Farmers Electric Co-op, but you also have a governing board as well. And the people who serve on your board seem to stick around for a long time.
We have had one complete change in the last 20 years of the board. But Terry's right. It's rural electrics are about local control by local boards. They're elected by the local membership. And we have a yearly annual meeting. So it's one customer, one vote. So it is very much local.
Do you find that you get a lot of phone calls from your customers with new ideas about electricity or just a lot of questions about electricity in their own homes?
I think the customers are as educated as we are today because of the internet. So, yeah, we do get a lot of calls.
Are you open to ideas when I know that, you know, some people have some very innovative ideas about green power solutions. Do you get suggestions from people?
That's part of the reason we started the solar garden was actually a mention at one of our meetings that we should be offering a solar option. So it did come from the membership.
Now, there are, of course, outside of any big city areas, you're based in Kelowna. Iowa City is pretty big and growing. There are, even in Kelowna, there are all these little subdivisions that are popping up around the city. Getting into the rural areas, does that change your customer base? Have you had some subdivisions pop up in your areas?
There are a few down in our area, but it's primarily the load is farm.
Okay. Jim, do you see that changing with the RECs that you work with? Do you see a lot of growth?
Well, interestingly, we're from north central, northwestern Iowa. So if we look at our area compared to other parts of the state, we've had, I'd say, either stable population or in some cases declining population. So that has been a challenge, you know, not just for REC electric co-ops, but for schools, for communities, for other businesses as well. So that's been a challenge. Now, we have pockets of growth, maybe in our case up around the Iowa Great Lakes area. But we've seen, interestingly, since I've been at Corn Belt about 30 years now, we used to be mostly residential in terms of our annual sales, kilowatt-hour sales. Today, that's kind of reversed, and now we're about 60 to 65%, we call it commercial, industrial, or agricultural sales. And to me, what that means is that farm population, the farm structures have changed quite a bit over the last that many years, and that's a big change that has affected our business.
Well, and when you talk about commercial, industrial, agricultural, does that mean that there are large commercial farms that are taking a lot of power and need a lot of support?
Yes, that would be one piece, you know, large livestock facilities, for example. But also in our area, the ethanol plants, again, in the last probably, I'm going to say, 4 or 5 years, have represented tremendous growth for us because those facilities, of course, they use the corn, which is the good point, but they also require a lot of energy in terms of motors, those kind of things, which require electricity, too.
Right. Well, look into the future, Jim. What do you think the biggest challenge will be in the next 10 years?
Well, we could look at the energy side or the co-op side, and I'm more involved in my job probably looking at the membership attitudes, member services kind of piece. One challenge we have, and I think it was interesting, we heard from the speaker a few minutes ago who actually was there when the lights turned on. Well, as people of that era are no longer around, we have members today who, first of all, they expect the light always to be on when they flip the switch, and if it's not, have no clue about what's the problem or where that is. And so the expectations of members are different today than in the past. So I'd say that's going to be the challenge because we still have Mother Nature that affects us for power supply. I mean, that's always going to be there, but it's not always connecting that to why doesn't my light switch work at home.
Right.
I think Jim's right. The reliability issue is probably 10 times more than what it used to be. People want power. They want it all the time.
And, Warren, and the dependence on that, too. I mean, how many electronics do people have today that require a little box to plug in every night that they didn't have even
right.
5 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim Sayers, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much.
Jim Sayers is Energy Services Director of Corn Belt Power Cooperative based in Humboldt, Iowa. And Warren McKenna, thank you.
Thanks.
Warren McKenna is General Manager of Farmers Electric Co-op based in Kelowna. And Terry, why do you think it's important for us, before I let you go, important for us to know about this history, this period where power came to rural Iowa?
Well, I think the same reason it's important to know about any history, for starters. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago. We're talking the 1940s. And, you know, there are pockets that weren't online until around 1950. So this really wasn't very long ago. And so to just really understand it and how that has changed our lives and to not take that electricity for granted. And with that, I have to say no talk about the RECs is complete without an ode to the lineman who is out there climbing up those poles in the middle of the blizzard to make sure that you have electricity in your home. And that hasn't changed all the way through. But, you know, we need to understand where that comes from, and we need to be very valuable players in the future of electric production.
Well, Terry, thank you so much. Terry Quek-Matsey, she's a journalist based in Fontanelle and author of How the Prairie Was Lit, an article recently published in Iowan Magazine. This is Talk of Iowa. With me now is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. What's coming up today at noon, Ben?
Hi, Charity. It's Wednesday, so it's Politics Wednesday. We're going to talk about some controversial remarks made by Senate candidate Bruce Braley, Democratic congressman, about Senator Chuck Grassley. It's lighting up a lot of pundits. So we'll talk about that. Also, a new ad by Joni Ernst, the GOP Senate hopeful. Lots to talk about. We hope our listeners will join in the conversation.
All right. River to River today at noon. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Public Radio.